she said. I'm sorry, I thought you said you were going through a divorce.
We've split, and we've both hired lawyers.
And who is your attorney?
Mr. Wilbanks.
Lucian flinched as if this was news to him. Ernie let it settle in, then continued. Who is your husband's lawyer?
I can't remember his name.
Is he suing you for a divorce, or is it the other way around?
It's a mutual thing.
How many other men were you sleeping with?
Just Danny.
I see. And where do you live over in Tupelo?
An apartment.
How much is the rent?
$200 a month.
And you live there with your child?
Yes.
Does the child work?
The child is 5 years old.
So how do you pay the rent and utilities?
I get by.
No one could have possibly believed her answer. What kind of car do you drive? She hesitated again. It was the kind of question that required an answer that could be verified with a few phone calls.
A 68 Mustang.
That's a nice car. When did you get it? Again, there was a paper trail here, and even Lydia, who wasn't bright, could see the trap.
Couple of months ago, she said defiantly.
Is the car titled in your name?
It is.
Is the apartment lease in your name?
It is.
Paperwork, paperwork. She couldn't lie about it, and she certainly couldn't afford it. Ernie took some notes from Hank Hooten and studied them suspiciously. How long did you sleep with Danny Paget?
15 minutes, usually.
In a tense courtroom, the answer provided scattered laughter. Ernie removed his glasses, rubbed them with the end of his tie, gave her a nasty grin, and rephrased the question. Your affair with Danny Paget, how long did it last?
Almost a year.
Where did you first meet him?
At the clubs up at the state line.
Did someone introduce the two of you?
I really don't remember. He was there, I was there, we had a dance, one thing led to another.
There was no doubt that Lydia Vince had spent many nights in many honky-tonks, and she'd never run from a new dance partner. Ernie needed just a few more lies that he could nail down. He asked a series of questions about her background and her husband's, birth, education, marriage, employment, family, names and dates and events that could be verified as true or false. She was for sale. The Pagets had found a witness they could buy. As we left the courtroom late that afternoon, I was confused and uneasy. I had been convinced for many months that Danny Paget killed Rhoda Castlelaw, and I still had no doubts. But the jury suddenly had something to hang itself with. A sworn witness had committed a dreadful act of perjury, but it was possible that a juror could have a reasonable doubt. Ginger was more depressed than me, so we decided to get drunk. We bought burgers and fries and a case of beer and went to her small motel room where we ate and then drowned our fears and hatred of a corrupt judicial system. We tried watching television, but nothing held our interest. We grew weary of worrying about the trial. As I was about to fall asleep, Ginger walked out of the bathroom naked, and the night took a turn for the better. We made love off and on until the alcohol prevailed and we fell asleep. Unknown to me, and there was no reason it should have been known to me because I was such a newcomer to the community and certainly not involved in judicial affairs, and besides, I literally had my hands full of Ginger, and for a few wonderful hours we lost interest in the trial, a secret meeting took place shortly after adjournment on Wednesday. Ernie Gaddis went to Harry Rex's office for a post-trial drink, and both admitted they were sick over Lydia's testimony. They began making phone calls, and within an hour they had rounded up a group of lawyers they could trust, and a couple of politicians as well. The opinion was unanimous that the Pagets were in the process of wiggling out of what appeared to be a solid case against them. An acquittal in such an open and shut case would infuriate the town and mock the court system. A hung jury would send a similar message. Justice could be bought in Ford County. There was a consensus that a hung jury was entirely possible. As a believable witness, Lydia Vance left much to be desired. But the jurors were not as savvy about fabricated testimony and crooked clients. The lawyers agreed that Farguson, the crippled boy, appeared hostile to the prosecution. Mr. John Deere also had them worried. His real name was Mo Teal, and he'd been a mechanic down at the tractor place for over 20 years. He was a simple man with a limited wardrobe. Late Monday afternoon, when the jury was finally selected and Judge Lupus sent them home to hurriedly pack for the bus, Mo had simply loaded up his week's supply of work uniforms. Each morning he marched into the jury box wearing a bright yellow shirt with green trim and green pants with yellow trim, as if he was ready for another vigorous day of pulling wrenches. Mo sat with his arms crossed and frowned whenever Ernie Gaddis was on his feet. His body language terrified the prosecution. Harry Rex thought it was important to find Lydia's estranged husband. If they were in fact going through a divorce, it was more than likely not an amicable one. It was difficult to believe she was having an affair with Danny Paget, but at the same time it seemed likely that the woman was no stranger to extramarital activity. The husband might have testimony that could severely discredit Lydia's. Ernie wanted to dig into her private life. He wanted to create doubt about her finances so he could yell at the jury, "How can she live so comfortably when she's unemployed and going through a divorce?" "Because she got $25,000 from the Pagets," one of the lawyers said. Speculation about the amount of the bribe became a running debate as the night wore on. The search for Malcolm Vince began with Harry Rex and two others calling every lawyer within five counties. Around 10 p.m., they found a lawyer in Corinth, 2 hours away, who said he had met with a Malcolm Vince once about a divorce, but had not been retained. Mr. Vince was living in a trailer somewhere out in the boondocks near the Tishomingo County line. He could not remember where he worked, but he was sure he had written it down in his file at the office. The district attorney himself got on the phone and coaxed the lawyer back to the office. At 8 o'clock the next morning, about the time I was leaving Ginger at the motel, Judge Lupus readily agreed to order a subpoena from Malcolm Vince. 20 minutes later, a Corinth City policeman stopped a forklift in a warehouse and informed its operator that a subpoena had just been issued for his appearance in a murder trial over in Ford County. "You got two choices, pal," explained the cop. "Stay here with me till they come get you, or we can leave now and get it over with." Malcolm's boss told him to leave and hurry back. After a 90-minute delay, the jury was brought in. Mr. John Deere was as spiffy as ever, but the rest were beginning to look tired. It seemed like the trial had been going on for a month. Miss Callie searched me out and gave me a restrained grin, not one of her spectacular day brighteners. She was still clutching a small New Testament. Ernie rose and informed the court that he had no further questions for Lydia Vince. Lucian said he was through with her, too. Ernie said he had a rebuttal witness he would like to call out of order. Lucian Wilbanks objected, and they haggled over it at the bench. When Lucian learned who the witness was, he became visibly upset. A good sign. Evidently, Judge Lupus was concerned about a bad verdict as well. He ruled against the defense, and a thoroughly bewildered Malcolm Vince was called into the packed courtroom to testify. Ernie had spent less than 10 minutes with him in a back room, so he was as unprepared as he was confused. Ernie started slow, with the basics: name, address, employment, recent family history. Malcolm somewhat reluctantly admitted being married to Lydia, and shared her desire to escape from the union. He said he had seen neither his wife nor his child in about a month. He knew she was unemployed, but living in a nice apartment. "You're not paying for her apartment?" Ernie asked with great suspicion, glancing warily at the jury. "No, sir, I am not." "Is her family paying for her apartment?" "Her family couldn't pay for one night in a motel," Malcolm said with no small amount of satisfaction. Once excused, Lydia had left the courtroom and was probably in the process of fleeing the country. Her act was complete, her performance over, her fee collected. She would never again set foot in Ford County. It's doubtful her presence would have inhibited Malcolm's testimony, but her absence gave him free rein to take all the cheap shots he wanted. "You're not close to her family?" Ernie asked, a throwaway question. "Most of them are in jail." "I see." She testified yesterday that a couple of months ago she bought a 1968 Ford Mustang. Did you help her with this purchase?
I did not.
Any idea how this unemployed woman could make this purchase?
Ernie asked, glancing at Danny Paget.
No.
Do you know if she's made any other unusual purchases lately?
Malcolm looked at the jury, saw some friendly faces, and said,
Yeah, she bought a new color television for herself and a new motorcycle for her brother.
It appeared as if everyone at the defense table had stopped breathing. The strategy over there had been to sneak Lydia in quietly, let her tell her lies, verify the alibi, get her off the stand, then push the case to a verdict before she could be discredited. She had known very few people in the county and now lived an hour away. The strategy was unraveling with disastrous results, and the entire courtroom could see and feel the tension between Lucian and his client.
"Do you know a man by the name of Danny Paget?"
Ernie asked.
"Never heard of him," Malcolm said.
"Your wife testified yesterday that she had been having an affair with him for almost a year."
It's rare to see an unsuspecting husband confronted with such news in such a public manner, but Malcolm seemed to handle it well.
"That's so," he said.
"Yes, sir. She testified the affair ended about 2 months ago."
"Well, sir, I'll tell you. That's kind of hard to believe."
"And why is that?"
Malcolm was squirming, suddenly interested in his feet.
"Well, it's really kind of personal, you know," he said.
"Yes, Mr. Vance, I'm sure it is. But sometimes personal matters have to be discussed in open court. A man is on trial here, charged with murder. This is serious business, and we need to know the truth."
Malcolm swung his left leg over his right knee and scratched his chin for a few seconds.
"Well, sir, it's like this. We stopped having sex about 2 years ago. That's why we're getting a divorce, you know."
"Any particular reason you stopped having sex?" Ernie asked as he held his breath.
"Yes, sir. She told me she hated sex with me. Said it made her sick to her stomach. Said she preferred sex with, you know, other ladies."
Lucian waived his right to question Malcolm Vince. After a long recess, he rose slowly and addressed the court. "Your Honor, the defense has no other witnesses. However, my client wishes to testify. I want it stated clearly in the record that he will testify against my advice."
"Duly noted,"
Lupus said.
"A very stupid mistake. Unbelievable,"
Baggy whispered loud enough for half the courtroom to hear. Danny Paget jumped up and strutted to the witness stand. His attempt at smiling came across as nothing but a smirk. His attempt at confidence came across as cockiness. He was sworn to tell the truth, but no one expected to hear it. "Why do you insist on testifying?" was Lucian's first question, and the courtroom was still and silent.
"Because I want these good people to hear what really happened,"
Paget answered, looking at the jurors.
"Then tell them," Lucian said, waving his hand at the jury.
Danny's version of events was wonderfully creative because there was no one to rebut him. Lydia was gone. Rhoda was dead. He began by saying that he had spent a few hours with his girlfriend, Lydia Vince, who lived less than half a mile from Rhoda Castlelaw. He knew exactly where Rhoda lived because he had visited her on several occasions. She wanted a serious romance, but he'd been too occupied with Lydia. Yes, he and Rhoda had had intimate relations on two occasions. They'd met at the clubs at the state line and spent many hours drinking and dancing. She was hot and loose and known to sleep around. As insult was added to injury, Ginger lowered her head and covered her ears. It was not missed by the jury. He didn't believe Lydia's husband's garbage about her homosexual tendencies. The woman enjoyed the intimacy of men. Malcolm was lying so he could win custody of their child. Paget was not a bad witness, but then he was testifying for his life. Every answer was quick. There were too many fake smiles toward the jury box. His narrative was clean and neat and fit too nicely together. I listened to him and watched the jurors, and I didn't see much sympathy.
Fargus and the crippled boy appeared just as skeptical as he had with every other witness. Mr. John Deere still sat with his arms wrapped across his chest, frowning. Miss Callie had no use for Paget, but then she would probably send him to prison for the adultery as quickly as for the murder. Lucian kept it brief. His client had plenty of rope with which to hang himself. No sense making it easier for the state. When Lucian sat down, he glared at the elder Pagets as if he truly hated them. Then he braced himself for what was about to come. Cross-examining such a guilty criminal is a prosecutor's dream. Ernie deliberately walked to the exhibit table and lifted Danny's bloody shirt. "Exhibit number 8," he said to the court reporter, holding it up for the jury to see again. "Where'd you buy this shirt, Mr. Paget?" Danny froze, uncertain as to whether he should deny it was his or admit ownership, or try and recall where he bought the damn thing. "You didn't steal it, did you?" Ernie roared at him.
"I did not."
"Then answer my question, and please try to remember you're under oath. Where did you buy this shirt?" As Ernie talked, he held the shirt in front of him with his fingertips, as if the blood were still wet and might spot his suit.
"Over in Tupelo, I think. I really don't remember. It's just a shirt."
"I see. And when you were in bed with Lydia that night, had you removed the shirt?" A very cautious,
"Yes."
"Where was it while the two of you were, having relations?"
"On the floor, I guess."
Now that it was firmly established that the shirt was his, Ernie was free to slaughter the witness. He pulled out the report from the state crime lab, read it to Danny, and asked him about Rhoda's bloodstains. If he was in bed with Lydia, with the shirt on the floor, how in the world did Rhoda's blood find its way from her bedroom to Lydia's, a half mile away? "It was a conspiracy," Danny said, advancing a new theory and digging a hole he would never get out of. Too much time alone in a jail cell can be dangerous for a guilty criminal.
"Well,"
he tried to explain, "someone either stained his shirt with Rhoda's blood," a theory that lightened up the crowd considerably, "or maybe it was more likely that some mysterious person who examined the shirt was simply lying, all in an effort to convict him." Ernie had a field day with both scenarios, but he landed his heaviest blows with a series of brutal questions about why Danny, who certainly had the money to hire the best lawyers around, didn't hire his own expert to come to court and explain the tainted blood exams to the jury. At 12:30, Lucian stood and suggested a break for lunch.
"I'm not done,"
Ernie yelled across the courtroom. He wanted to finish the annihilation before Lucian could get his hands on his client and try to rehabilitate him, a task that seemed impossible.
"Continue,"
Judge Lupus said, and Ernie asked Paget about the piece of his skin found under Rhoda's fingernail.
"Was that part of the conspiracy?"
"And his own semen." And on and on. Ernie hammered away. Occasionally, Lucian would glance over his shoulder at Danny's father with a look that said, "I told you so." Danny's presence on the stand allowed Ernie to once more trot out all the evidence, and the impact was devastating. His weak protests that everything was tainted by a conspiracy sounded ridiculous, even laughable. Watching him get thoroughly decimated before the jury was quite gratifying. The good guys were winning. The jury seemed primed to pull out rifles and form a firing squad. Ernie tossed his legal pad on his table and appeared ready for lunch, finally. He jammed both hands into his front pockets, glared at the witness, and said,
"Under oath, you're telling this jury you didn't rape and murder Rhoda Castlelaw?"
"I didn't do it."
"You didn't follow her home from the state line that Saturday night?"
"No, I wasn't there."
"You weren't there," Ernie bellowed, and the walls seemed to shake. "Your shirt was there. You left your semen there. You think this jury is stupid, Mr. Paget?"
The witness kept shaking his head. Ernie walked slowly to his chair and pulled it from under the table. As he was about to sit, he said,
"You're a rapist, you're a murderer, and you're a liar, aren't you, Mr. Paget?"
Lucian was up and yelling,
"Objection, Your Honor! This is enough!"
"Sustained. Any further questions, Mr. Gaddis?"
"No, Your Honor. The state is finished with this witness."
"Any redirect, Mr. Wilbanks?"
No, Your Honor.
The witness may step down. Danny slowly got to his feet. Long gone was the smirk, the swagger. His face was red with anger and wet with sweat. As he was about to step out of the witness box and return to the defense table, he suddenly turned to the jury and said something that stunned the courtroom. His face wrinkled into pure hatred, and he jabbed his right index finger into the air.
"You convict me," he said, "and I'll get every damn one of you."
"Bailiff," Judge Lupus said as he grabbed for his gavel. "That's enough, Mr. Paget."
"Every damned one of you,"
Danny repeated louder. Ernie jumped to his feet but could think of nothing to say, and why should he? The defendant was strangling himself. Lucian was on his feet, equally uncertain about what to do. Two deputies raced forward and shoved Paget toward the defense table. As he walked away, he glared at the jurors as if he might just throw a grenade right then. When things settled, I realized my heart was pounding with excitement. Even Baggy was too stunned to speak.
"Let's break for lunch," His Honor said, and we fled the courtroom. I was no longer hungry. I felt like racing to my apartment and taking a shower.
The trial resumed at 3 p.m. All the jurors were present. The Pageants hadn't knocked one off during lunch. Miss Callie gave me a grin, but her heart was not in it. Judge Lupus explained to the jury that it was now time for the closing arguments, after which he would read to them his formal instructions, and they should have the case to decide in a couple of hours or so. They listened carefully, but I'm sure they were still reeling from the shock of being so flagrantly intimidated. The entire town was reeling. The jurors were a sampling of us, the rest of the community, and to threaten them was to do the same to everyone. Ernie went first, and within minutes the buddy's shirt was back in play. He was careful, though, not to overdo it. The jurors understood. They knew the evidence well. The district attorney was thorough but surprisingly brief. As he made his last appeal for a verdict of guilty, we watched the faces of the jurors. I saw no sympathy for the defendant. Farguson, the crippled boy, was actually nodding as he followed along with Ernie. Mr. John Deere had uncrossed his arms and was listening to every word. Lucian was even briefer, but then he had far less to work with. He began by addressing his client's final words to the jury. He apologized for his behavior. He blamed it on the pressure of the moment. Imagine, he asked the jurors, being 24 years old and facing either life in prison or worse, the gas chamber. Stress on his young client, he always referred to him as Danny, as if he was an innocent little boy, was so enormous that he was concerned about his mental stability. The state had the chance for a rebuttal. The defense did not, so Ernie got the last word. He ignored the evidence and did not mention the defendant, but chose instead to talk about Rhoda and her children.
"They were there when she died. What they saw was so horrible that they will be forever scarred. They have a voice here in this courtroom, and their voice belongs to you."
Judge Lupus read his instructions to the jury, then sent them back to begin their deliberations. It was after 5 p.m., a time when the shops around the square were closed and the merchants and their customers were long gone. Traffic was normally light, parking was easy. But not when a jury is out. Much of the crowd lingered on the courthouse lawn, smoking, gossiping, predicting how long a verdict would take. Others crowded into the cafes for a late coffee or an early dinner. Ginger followed me to my office, where we sat on the balcony and watched the activity around the courthouse. She was emotionally wasted and wanted to do nothing but get out of Ford County.
"How well do you know Hank Hooten?" she asked at one point.
"I never met him. Why?"
"He caught me during lunch. Said he knew Rhoda well. Said he knew for a fact that she was not sleeping around, especially not with Danny Paget. I told him I did not believe for an instant that she was seeing that scumbag."
"Did he say he dated her?" I asked.
"He wouldn't say, but I got the impression he did. When we were going through her things a week or so after the funeral, I found his name and phone number in her address book. I guess I should feel better knowing my sister was sleeping with a lawyer."
"Why would that make you feel better?"
"I don't know." She'd kicked off her heels and her short skirt was even higher up her thighs. I began to rub them, and my thoughts drifted away from the trial. But only for a moment. There was a commotion around the front door of the courthouse, and I heard someone yell something about a verdict. After deliberating for less than 1 hour, the jury was ready. When the lawyers and spectators were in place, Judge Lupus told a bailiff, "Bring 'em in."
"Guilty as hell,"
Baggy whispered to me as the door opened and Farguson came limping out first.
"Quick verdicts are always guilty."
For the record, Baggy had predicted a hung jury, but I didn't remind him of that. Not then, anyway. The foreman handed a folded sheet of paper to the bailiff, who then gave it to the judge. Lupus examined it for a long time, then leaned down close to his microphone.
"Would the defendant please rise?" he said.
Both Paget and Lucian stood, slowly and awkwardly, as if a firing squad was taking aim. Judge Lupus read,
"As to count one, the charge of rape, we, the jury, find the defendant, Danny Paget, guilty. As to count two, the charge of capital murder, we, the jury, find the defendant, Danny Paget, guilty."
Lucian didn't flinch, and Paget tried not to. He looked at the jurors with as much venom as he could convey, but he was getting more of it in return.
"You may be seated,"
His Honor said, then turned to the jury.
"Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your service so far. This completes the guilt or innocence phase of the trial. Now we move to the capital phase in which you will be asked to decide whether this defendant gets a death sentence or life in prison. You will now return to your hotel, and we will recess until 9 in the morning. Thank you and good night."
It was over so quickly that most of the spectators didn't move for a moment. They led Paget out, in handcuffs this time, and his family seemed completely bewildered. Lucian had no time to chat with him. Baggy and I went to the office where he began typing with a fury. The deadline was days away, but we wanted to capture the moment. Typically, though, he faded after a half hour when the sour mash called. It was almost dark when Ginger returned, in tight jeans, tight shirt, hair down, a look that said, "Take me somewhere." We stopped at Quincy's again, where I bought another six-pack for the road, and with the top down and the warm, muggy air blowing by us, we headed for Memphis, 90 minutes away. She said little, and I didn't poke around. She had been forced by her family to attend the trial. She hadn't asked for this nightmare. Luckily, she'd found me for a little fun. I'll never forget that night. Racing the dark, empty back roads, drinking a cold beer, holding hands with a beautiful lady who'd come looking for me, one I'd already slept with and was sure to do so again. Our sweet little romance had but a few hours left. I could almost count them. Baggy thought the penalty phase would take less than a day, so the trial would end tomorrow, Friday. Ginger couldn't wait to leave Clanton and shake the dust off her shoes, and of course there was no way I could leave with her. I'd checked an atlas. Springfield, Missouri was far away, at least a 6-hour drive. Commuting would be difficult, though I'd certainly try if she wanted me to. But something told me Ginger would vanish from my life as quickly as she had appeared. I was sure she had a boyfriend or two back home, so I wouldn't be welcome. And if she saw me in Springfield, she would be reminded of Ford County and its horrible memories. Friday morning in the hallway outside the courtroom, Esau Ruffin found me and had a pleasant surprise. Three of his sons, Al, Max, and Bobby, Alberto, Massimo, and Roberto, were with him, anxious to say hello to me. I had spoken to all three a month earlier when I was doing the feature on Miss Callie and her children. We shook hands and exchanged pleasantries. They politely thanked me for my friendship with their mother and for the kind words I'd written about their family. They were as soft-spoken, pleasant, and as articulate as Miss Callie. They had arrived late the night before to give her moral support. Esau had talked to her once all week. Each juror had been given one phone call, and she was holding up well but worried about her blood pressure. We chatted for a moment as the crowd pushed toward the courtroom and walked in together. They sat directly behind me. A few moments later, when Miss Callie took her seat, she looked at me and saw her three sons. The smile was like a bolt of lightning. The fatigue around her eyes vanished immediately. During the trial, I had seen in her face a certain amount of pride. She was sitting where no black person had ever sat, shoulder to shoulder with fellow citizens, judging a white person for the first time in Ford County. I'd also had hints of the anxiety that comes with venturing into untested waters. Now that her sons were there to watch, pride filled her face, and there was no evidence of fear. She sat a bit straighter, and though she'd missed nothing in the courtroom so far, her eyes darted everywhere, anxious to capture what was coming and finish her task. Judge Lupus explained to the jurors that in the penalty phase, the state would offer evidence of aggravating circumstances in support of its request for the death penalty. The defense would offer mitigating proof. He did not expect it to take long. It was Friday. The trial had already lasted forever. The jurors and everybody else in Clanton wanted Paget shipped off so life could return to normal. Ernie Gaddis correctly gauged the mood in the courtroom. He thanked the jurors for their proper verdict of guilty and confessed that he felt no further testimony was necessary. Instead, he delivered an impassioned plea for the death penalty. He explained why it was a deterrent and a punishment. He quoted scripture. He wrapped it up by reminding the jurors that each had been selected on Monday after promising that they could follow the law. He read them the law enacting the death penalty. "The state of Mississippi has proven its case," he said, closing the thick green law book. "You have found Danny Paget guilty of rape and murder. The law now calls for the death penalty. You are duty-bound to deliver it." According to Baggy, in a capital case, the defendant, after protesting his innocence throughout the trial and being nailed by the jury, usually took the stand and said he was very sorry for whatever crime he'd been denying all week. "They beg and cry," Baggy had said. "It's quite a show." But Paget's disaster the day before precluded him from getting near the jury. Lucian called to the witness stand his mother, Letty Paget. She was a 50-ish woman with pleasant features and short graying hair, and she wore a black dress as if she was already mourning the death of her son. Led by Lucian, she unsteadily began testimony that seemed scripted down to every pause in her cadence. The testimony was silly and self-serving, but there were three mothers on the jury, Miss Callie, Mrs. Barbara Baldwin, and Maxine Root, and Lucian needed just one. Not surprisingly, Mrs. Paget was soon in tears. Her pain was real. Her emotions were raw and difficult to watch, to sit through. She finally collapsed and Lucian left her sobbing on the witness stand. He said he had no other witnesses. He and Ernie made brief final summations, and by 11 a.m. the jury once again had the case. Ginger disappeared into the crowd. I went to the office and waited. And when she didn't show, I walked across the square to Harry Rex's office. He sent his secretary out for sandwiches, and we ate in his cluttered conference room.
"Is your gal gonna stick?"
he asked with a mouthful of turkey and Swiss. "Miss Callie?" I asked.
"Yeah? She okay with the gas chamber?"
"I have no idea. We haven't discussed it."
"She's got us worried, along with that damn cripple boy."
Harry Rex had quietly involved himself in the case in such a way that one would think he was working for Ernie Gaddis in the state. "It took them less than 60 minutes to find him guilty," I said. "Isn't that a good sign?"
"Maybe. But jurors do strange things when it's time to sign a death warrant."
"So, then he'll get life. From what I hear about Parchman, life there would be worse than a gas chamber."
"Life ain't life, Willie,"
he said, wiping his face with a paper towel. I put my sandwich down while he took another bite. "What is life?" I asked.
10 years, maybe less."
I tried to understand this. "You mean a life sentence in Mississippi is 10 years?
"You got it. After 10 years, less with good time, a murderer sent to prison for life is eligible for parole. Insane, don't you think?"
"But why?"
"Don't try and understand it, Willie. It's just the law. Been on the books for 50 years, and what's worse is the jury doesn't know it. Can't tell them. Want some coleslaw?"
I shook my head.
"Our distinguished Supreme Court has said that the jury, if it knows how light a life sentence really is, might be more inclined to give the death penalty. Thus, it's unfair to the defendant. Ain't that the damnedest thing?
After 3 hours of deliberation, the jury slipped a note to Judge Lupus. They were deadlocked and making little progress. He called things to order, and we raced across the street. If the jury could not reach a unanimous verdict for the death penalty, then by law, the judge imposed a life sentence. Fear pervaded the crowd as we waited for the jurors. Something was going wrong back there. Had the Pagets finally found their mark? Miss Callie was stone-faced, a look I'd never seen. Mrs. Barbara Baldwin had obviously been crying. Several of the men gave the impression that their fist fight had just been broken up, and that they were anxious to resume the brawl. The foreman stood and very nervously explained to His Honor that the jury was divided and had made absolutely no progress in the last hour. He was not optimistic about a unanimous verdict, and all were ready to go home. Judge Lupus then asked each juror if he or she thought a unanimous verdict could be reached. They unanimously said no. I could feel the anger rise among the crowd. People were fidgeting and whispering, and this certainly didn't help the jurors. Judge Lupus then delivered what Baggy later described as the dynamite charge, an off-the-cuff lecture about following the law and keeping promises made during jury selection. It was a stern and lengthy admonishment, loaded with no small measure of desperation. It didn't work. 2 hours later, a stunned courtroom listened as Judge Lupus quizzed the jurors again, with the same result. He grudgingly thanked them and sent them home. When they were gone, he called Danny Paget forward, and on the record, gave him a tongue-lashing that made my skin crawl. He called him a rapist, murderer, coward, liar, and worst of all, a thief for having taken from two small children the only parent they had. It was a scalding, withering assault. I tried to write it word for word, but it was so compelling I had to stop and listen. A rabid street preacher could not have heaped such abuse upon sin. If he had the power, he would sentence him to death, and a rapid and painful one at that. But the law was the law, and he had to follow it. He sentenced him to life and ordered Sheriff Coley to immediately transport him to the state penitentiary at Parchman. Coley slapped handcuffs on him, and he was gone. Ginger didn't show. She said she would stop by the office after she checked out and say goodbye, but she obviously changed her mind. I could see her speeding through the night, crying and cursing and counting the miles until she was out of Mississippi. Who could blame her? Our 3-day fling came to an abrupt end the way both of us expected, but neither had admitted. I could not imagine our paths ever crossing again, and if they did, it would be another round or two in the sack before we got distracted with life and moved on. In the heat of the moment, I began writing an editorial about the verdict. It would be a scathing attack on the criminal laws of the state. It would be honest and heartfelt, and it would also play well with the audience. Esau called and interrupted me. He was at the hospital with Miss Callie and asked me to hurry down. She had fainted as she was getting into the car outside the courthouse. Esau and the three sons had rushed her in, and wisely so. Her blood pressure was dangerously high, and the doctor was worried about a stroke. After a couple of hours, though, she had stabilized and her outlook was better. I held her hand briefly, told her I was very proud of her, and so on. What I really wanted was the inside story on what happened back in the jury room. It was a story I would never forget. I went to the office on Saturday after the verdict around noon. I had several stories about the trial I wanted to write, plus my editorial was far from finished. Wiley Meek stopped by with the town gossip. Folks were hot in the coffee shops. Paget was a dirty word. Lucian Wilbanks was despised, but that was nothing new. Sheriff Coley might as well retire. He wouldn't get 50 votes. Two opponents were already making noise, and the election was half a year away. As for the death penalty vote, there were two primary theories roaring around the square that morning. First, Miss Callie had screwed things up simply because she was black. Second, the Pagets had dropped some cash on two or three of the jurors, same as they had done on that lying bitch, Lydia Vince. Wiley thought the second had more supporters than the first.
though many seemed perfectly willing to believe anything, I was learning that coffee shop gossip was useless. Late Saturday afternoon, I crossed the tracks and drove slowly through Lowtown. People waved and stared, more amused at my little car than my pale skin. There was a crowd on Miss Callie's porch. Al, Max, and Bobby were there, along with Reverend Thurston Small and another well-dressed deacon from the church. Esau was in the house tending to his wife. She had been discharged that morning, with strict instructions to stay in bed for 3 days and not lift a finger. Max led me back to her bedroom. She was sitting in bed, propped up with pillows, reading the Bible. She flashed a smile when she saw me and said, "Mr. Trainer, so nice of you to come. Please sit. Esau, fetch Mr. Trainer some tea." Esau, as always, jumped when she gave orders. Miss Callie looked into my eyes. "We didn't do a good job, did we, Mr. Trainer?" Her words were filled with both sadness and frustration. "It's not a popular verdict," I said.
"It's not what I wanted," she said.
In late September, there were two notable deaths in 1 week. The first was Mr. Wilson Caudle. He died at home, alone, in the bedroom where he'd secluded himself since the day he walked out of the Times. He died on a Thursday, and the funeral was on Saturday. It was my fourth funeral since landing in Clanton. Except for my mother's, I had never attended one before. They were social events in the small town. Folks took off work and wore their Sunday best. If you didn't go to funerals, then you were downright peculiar. Since I had enough oddities working against me, I was determined to properly honor the dead. The second death occurred later that night, and when I heard about it on Monday, I went to my apartment and found my pistol. Malcolm Vince was shot twice in the head as he left a honky-tonk in a very remote part of Tishomingo County. Tishomingo was dry, the tonk was illegal, and that's why it was hidden so deep in the sticks. There were no witnesses to the killing. Malcolm had been drinking beer and shooting pool, behaving himself generally and causing no trouble. Two acquaintances told the police that Malcolm left by himself around 11 p.m., after about 3 hours in the tonk. He was in good spirits and was not drunk. He said goodbye to them, walked outside, and within seconds they heard gunfire. They were almost certain he was not armed. Whoever killed Malcolm had come from the woods on foot and carried out the hit. I talked to the sheriff of Tishomingo County. He was of the opinion that someone was after Malcolm. It certainly wasn't a garden variety honky-tonk flare-up. "Any idea who might be after Mr. Vince?" I asked, desperately hoping that Malcolm had made some enemies 2 hours away.
"No idea," he said. "The boy hadn't lived here long."
For 2 days, I carried the pistol in my pocket. Then again grew weary of that. If the Pagets wanted to get me or one of the jurors, or Judge Lupus, or Ernie Gaddis, or anyone they deemed guilty of helping send Danny away, then there was little we could do to stop them. The paper that week was devoted to Mr. Wilson Caudle. I pulled out some old photos from the archives and plastered them all over the front page. We ran testimonials, stories, and lots of paid announcements of sympathy from his many friends. I then rehashed everything I'd written about him into the longest obituary in the history of the newspaper. Spot deserved it. I wasn't sure what to do with the story about Malcolm Vince. If I exaggerated the story, the Pagets would get the satisfaction of further intimidating the county. They would frighten us again. Of those who'd heard of the killing, no one thought it might be the work of anyone other than the Pagets. If I ignored the story, then I would be running scared and shirking my responsibility as a journalist. Baggy thought it was front-page material, but there was no room when I was finished with our farewell to Mr. Caudle. I ran it at the top of page 3 with the headline, "Paget Witness Murdered in Tishomingo County." My first headline had been, "Malcolm Vince Murdered in Tishomingo County." But Baggy felt strongly that we should use the Paget name with the word "murdered" in the headline. The story was 300 words. The only Jew in Clanton was Mr. Harvey Cohn, a dapper little man who'd been selling shoes and handbags to ladies for decades. His store was on the square, next door to the Sullivan Law Firm, in a row of buildings he'd bought during the Depression. He ran the store himself, opening early and staying late, usually with the help of a part-time student. 2 years before I arrived in Clanton, he hired a 16-year-old black kid named Sam Ruffin to unpack inventory, move stock, clean the place, answer the phone. Sam proved to be bright and industrious. He was courteous, mannerly, well-dressed, and before long, he could be trusted to run the store while Mr. Cone went home every day at precisely 11:45 for a quick lunch and a long nap. A lady by the name of Iris Durant dropped in around noon one day and found Sam all alone. Iris was 41 years old, the mother of two teenage boys, one in Sam's class at Clanton High. She was mildly attractive, liked to flirt and wear miniskirts, and usually selected shoes from Mr. Cone's more exotic inventory. She tried about 2 dozen varieties, bought nothing, and took her time about it. Sam knew his products and was very careful with her feet. She was back the next day, same time, shorter skirt, heavier makeup. Barefoot, she seduced Sam on Mr. Cone's desk in his small office just behind the cash register. Thus began a torrid affair that would change both their lives. Several times a week, Iris went shoe shopping. Sam found a more comfortable spot upstairs on an old sofa. He would lock the store for 15 minutes, turn off the lights, and dash up. Iris's husband was a sergeant in the Mississippi Highway Patrol. Alarmed at the number of new shoes in her closet, he became suspicious. Suspicion had been a way of life with Iris. He hired Harry Rex to investigate. A Cub Scout could have caught the lovers. 3 straight days she walked into Cone's at the same time. 3 straight days Sam quickly locked the front door, eyes darting in all directions. 3 straight days the lights went off, etc. On the 4th day, Harry Rex sneaked in the back of the store. He heard noises upstairs, barged into the love nest, and in 5 seconds gathered enough evidence to send both of them packing. Mr. Cone fired Sam an hour later. Harry Rex filed the divorce that afternoon. Iris was later admitted to the hospital with cuts, abrasions, and a broken nose. Her husband beat her with his fist until she was unconscious. After dark, 3 uniformed state troopers knocked on the door of Sam's home in Lowtown. They explained to his parents that he was wanted by the police in connection with some vague embezzling charge at Cone's. If convicted, he could be sentenced to 20 years in prison. They also told them, off the record, of course, that Sam had been caught having sex with a white lady, another man's wife, and there was a contract on his head. $5,000. Iris left town disgraced, divorced, without her children, and afraid to return. I had heard different versions of Sam's story. It was old gossip by the time I arrived in Clanton, but it was still sensational enough to find its way into many conversations. In the South, it was not unusual for white men to keep black mistresses, but Sam's was the first documented case of a white woman crossing the color line in Clanton. Baggy had been the one to tell me the story. Harry Rex had confirmed much of it. Miss Callie refused to talk about it. Sam was her youngest, and he couldn't come home. He had fled, dropped out of high school, and spent the past 2 years living off his brothers and sisters. Now he was calling me. I went to the courthouse and dug through drawers of old files. I found no record of an indictment against Sam Ruffin. I asked Sheriff Coley if he had an outstanding warrant. He dodged the question and wanted to know why I was poking around in such an old case. I asked him if Sam would be arrested if he came home. Again, no direct answer. "Be careful, Mr. Trainer," he warned, but would not elaborate. I went to Harry Rex and asked about the now legendary contract on Sam's head. He described his client, Sergeant Durant, as a former Marine, an expert marksman with any number of weapons, a career cop, a hothead who was horribly embarrassed by Iris's indiscretion, and who felt the only honorable way out was to kill her lover. He had thought about killing her, but didn't want to go to prison. He felt safer killing a black kid. A Ford County jury would be more sympathetic.
"And he wants to do it himself," Harry Rex explained. "That way he can save the $5,000.
He enjoyed delivering such dire news to me,
but he did admit that he hadn't seen his client in a year and a half, and he wasn't sure if Mr. Durant hadn't already remarried. Thursday at noon, we settled down at the table on the porch and thanked the Lord for the delicious meal we were about to receive. Esau was at work. The meal that day was chicken and dumplings. I was eating slowly, something Miss Callie had encouraged me to do. I was half through when I said, "Sam called me, Miss Callie." She paused and swallowed, then said,
"How is he?"
"He's fine. He wants to come home this Christmas. Said everybody else was coming back, and he wants to be here."
"Do you know where he is?"
she asked. "Do you?"
"No."
"He's in Memphis," I said. "We're supposed to meet tomorrow, up there."
"Why are you meeting with Sam?"
She seemed very suspicious of my involvement. "He wants me to help him. Max and Bobby told him about our friendship. He said he thinks I'm a white person who can be trusted."
"It could be dangerous," she said.
"For who?"
"Both of you."
The next day, I became the unofficial go-between for Sam Ruffin and his parents. We met in a coffee shop in a shopping mall in South Memphis. From somewhere in the distance, he watched me wait for 30 minutes before he popped in from nowhere and sat across from me. 2 years on the run had taught him a few tricks. His youthful face was showing the strain of life on the lam. Out of habit, he continually looked right and left. He tried mightily to hold eye contact, but he could do it only for a few seconds. Not surprisingly, he was soft-spoken, articulate, very polite, and quite thankful that I'd been willing to step forward and explore the possibility of helping him.
"There's a fair amount of pressure on me, you know," he said.
"Seven brothers and sisters. 7 PhDs. I described my fruitless search for an indictment, my inquiries to Sheriff Coley, and my conversation with Harry Rex about Mr. Durant's current mood. "There's no threat of being arrested," I assured him. "There is, however, the threat of catching a bullet."
"I'd rather be arrested," he said.
"Me too."
"He's a very scary man," Sam said of Mr. Durant.
A story followed, one in which I did not get all the details. Seems as though Iris was now living in Memphis. Sam kept in touch. She had told him some horrible things about her ex-husband and her 2 teenage boys, and the threats they'd made against her. She was not welcome anywhere in Ford County. Her life might be in danger, too. The boys repeatedly said they hated her and never wanted to see her again. She was a broken woman who was racked with guilt and suffering a nervous breakdown.
"And it's my fault," Sam said.
"I was raised better." Our meeting lasted an hour, and we promised to get together in a couple of weeks. He handed me 2 thick letters he'd written to his parents, and we said goodbye. I told Harry Rex about our meeting in Memphis. My lofty goal was to somehow convince Mr. Durant to leave Sam alone. Since I was living under the assumption that my name was on a not-so-favored list somewhere on Paget Island, I had no desire to have it added to another list. I swore Harry Rex to secrecy, and had no trouble believing he would protect my role as the intermediary. Sam would agree to leave Ford County, to finish high school up north, then stay there for college and probably for the rest of his life. The kid simply wanted to be able to see his parents, to have short visits in Clanton, and to be able to live without looking over his shoulder. Harry Rex didn't care, nor did he want to get involved. He promised to relay the message to Mr. Durant, but he wasn't optimistic it would get a sympathetic ear.
"He's a nasty sumbitch," he said more than once.
Trooper Durant had been quite pleased to learn that his threats were still hanging over the head of Sam Ruffin. Harry Rex had eventually delivered the word that the boy was still on the run, but desperately wanted to come home and see his mama. Durant had not remarried. He was very much alone and extremely bitter and embarrassed about his wife's affair. He knew exactly where the Ruffins lived in Lowtown, and commented on the annual pilgrimage many blacks from the north made at Christmas time.
"If that boy sneaks home, we'll be waiting," he promised Harry Rex.
He also had some venom for me, and for my heartwarming stories about Miss Callie and her older children. He guessed correctly that I was the family's contact with Sam.
"You better get your nose out of this mess," Harry Rex warned me after his meeting with Durant. "This is a nasty character."
I wasn't anxious to have someone else dreaming of my painful death. I met Sam at a truck stop near the state line, about a mile into Tennessee. Miss Callie had sent cakes and pies and letters and some cash, an entire cardboard box that filled the other seat in my little Spitfire. It was the first time in 2 years she had been able to touch him in any way. He tried to read one of her letters, but became emotional and put it back in the envelope. "I'm so homesick," he said, wiping huge tears, while at the same time trying to hide them from the truckers eating nearby. He was a lost, scared little boy. With brutal honesty, I recounted the conversation with Harry Rex. Sam had naively thought his offer to stay away from Ford County but visit occasionally would be acceptable to Mr. Durant. He had little grasp of the hatred he had inspired. He did, however, seem to appreciate the danger. "He'll kill you, Sam," I said gravely. "And he'll get by with it, won't he? What difference would that make to you? You'll be just as dead. Miss Callie would rather have you alive up north than dead in the Clanton Cemetery." We agreed to meet again in 2 weeks. He was doing his Christmas shopping, and he would have gifts for his parents and family. We said goodbye and left the dining area. I was almost to my car when I decided to step back inside and use the men's room. It was in the rear of a tacky gift shop next to the cafe. I glanced out a window and saw Sam, very suspiciously, jump into a car driven by a white woman. She looked to be older, early 40s. Iris, I presumed. Some people never learn. The Ruffin clan began arriving 3 days before Christmas. Miss Callie had been cooking for a week. She sent me to the grocery store twice for emergency supplies. I was quickly adopted into the family and given full privileges, the highest of which was to eat whenever and whatever I wanted. Unlike their mother, the Ruffin children were not the slightest bit heavy, and I soon learned why. They complained that they were unable to eat like this anymore. The food where they lived was bland, and much of it was frozen and mass-produced. There were a lot of ethnic foods they simply could not digest, and the people ate in a hurry. The list of complaints grew. My hunch was that they had been so spoiled by Miss Callie's cooking that nothing would ever measure up. After a 3-hour lunch, Leonardo, who taught biology at Purdue, asked me to go for a ride. He was the second oldest and carried a slight academic air that the others had managed to avoid. We roamed the streets of Clanton in his car. He wanted to know about Sam, and I told him everything. In my opinion, whatever that was worth, it was too dangerous for him to enter Ford County. And he wanted to know about the trial of Danny Padgett. "Will he ever be released from prison?" Leon asked. "Yes," I said reluctantly. "When?" "No one knows. He got life for murder, life for rape. 10 years is the minimum for each, but I'm told weird things happen in the Mississippi parole system." "So it's 20 years minimum." I'm sure he was thinking about his mother's age. She was 59. "No one's sure," I said. "There is the possibility of good time, which reduces the minimum."
He seemed as confused by this as I had been.
Truth was, no one connected to either the judicial system or the penal system had been able to answer my questions about Danny's sentence. Parole in Mississippi was a vast, dark pit, and I was afraid to get too close. Leon told me that he had quizzed his mother at length about the verdict. "What do you know?" he asked me. "Not much," I thought to myself. She had strongly implied to me that she had not agreed with the verdict, but it was nothing definite. In the weeks after the verdict, there had been an avalanche of speculation. Most courthouse regulars had settled on the theory that 3, maybe 4 of the jurors had refused to vote for the death penalty. Miss Callie was generally considered not to be in that group. On Christmas Eve, I drove to Memphis, where my childhood home had not seen a Christmas decoration in 10 years. My father and I had dinner at a Chinese joint not far from the house. We ate quickly and went in different directions. Sadly, neither of us had given any thought to exchanging gifts. Christmas lunch was with Bibi, who, unlike my father, was delighted to see me. She invited 3 of her little blue-haired widow friends over for sherry and ham, and the 5 of us proceeded to get tipsy. I regaled them with stories from Ford County, some accurate, some highly embellished. Hanging around Baggy and Harry Rex, I was learning the art of storytelling. By 3 p.m., we were all napping. Early the next morning,
I raced back to Clanton. One frigid day in late January, shots rang out somewhere around the square. I was sitting at my desk, peacefully typing a story about Mr. Lamar Farlow and his recent reunion in Chicago with his battalion of Army paratroopers, when a bullet shattered a windowpane less than 20 feet from my head. The slow news week thus came to a sudden end. My bullet was either the second or the third in a fairly rapid sequence. I hit the floor with all sorts of thoughts. Where was my pistol? Were the Pagets assaulting the town? Were Trooper Duran and his boys after me? On my hands and knees, I scrambled to my briefcase as shots continued to crack through the air. They sounded like they were coming from across the street, but in the horror of the moment, I really couldn't tell. They sounded much louder after one hit my office. I emptied the briefcase and then remembered the pistol was either in my car or my apartment. I was unarmed and felt like such a weakling for not being able to defend myself. There was a pause in the assault, then shouts of panic and chaos on the streets. It was almost 2 p.m., normally a busy time downtown. I crawled under my desk like I'd been taught in tornado warning drills. Then the shots resumed. They weren't getting any closer, I decided, as I tried to breathe normally under the desk and analyze things. As the seconds slowly ticked by, I realized that the assault was not aimed at me. I just happened to own a nearby window. Sirens approached, then more shots, more shouting. What in the world? A phone rang downstairs and someone grabbed it quickly. Willie, you okay? Big Mouth Bass yelled from the bottom of the steps. Yeah. There's a sniper on top of the courthouse. Great. Stay low. Don't worry. I relaxed a little and emerged just enough to grab my phone. I called Wiley Meek at home, but he was already headed our way. Then I crawled across the floor to one of the French doors and opened it. Evidently, this caught the attention of our sniper. He shattered a pane 4 feet above me, and the glass fell like heavy rain. I dropped to my stomach and stopped breathing for what seemed like an hour. The gunfire was relentless. Whoever he was certainly perturbed about something. When I could move again, I gently pulled one of the rocking chairs over on its side, then crawled behind it. The porch had a wrought iron railing around it, and with that and the chair in front of me, I was concealed and protected. I'm not sure why I felt compelled to move closer to the sniper, but I was 24 years old and owned the newspaper and knew that I would write a lengthy story about this dramatic episode. I needed details. When I finally peeked through the chair on the railing, I saw the sniper. The courthouse had an oddly flattened dome, on top of which was a small cupola with 4 open windows. He'd made his nest there, and when I first saw him, he was peeking just above the sill of one of the windows. He appeared to have a black face with white hair, and this sent more chills through my body. We were dealing with a world-class psycho. He was reloading, and when he was ready, he rose slightly and began shooting completely at random. He appeared to be shirtless, which, given the situation, seemed even stranger since it was around 30 degrees with a chance of light snow later in the afternoon. His chest was white with black stripes, sort of like a zebra. It was a white man who painted himself partially black. All traffic was gone. The city police had blocked the streets and cops were darting about, squatting low and hiding behind their cars. In the store windows, an occasional face popped out for a quick scan, then disappeared. The shooting stopped and the sniper ducked low and disappeared for a while. 3 county deputies dashed along a sidewalk and into the courthouse. Long minutes passed. Wiley Meek bounded up the steps of